This is part two of the conversation with Peter Colinad. I'm really sorry. Every day, my internet provider seems to just like introduce a 15 minutes of fun where the internet just drops out. So, so fingers crossed. So, I'm sorry, Gita. So we were just talking about, what were we talking about? Oh, we were talking about embodiment. We were talking about... about the way in which, so you were kind of wanting to correct a lot of misconceptions about Kalaripayat and Indian dance in the written form. So you wanted, part of your project is to bring a kind of intellectual articulate literacy into writing about Kalaripayat. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when unless I read Philip's book 20 odd years ago, I think it's more like 25 years since he wrote his book. If I wanted to read anything then, it was all just descriptive instruction manuals. This is how you do Nedkal, this is how you do, or this is what comes next, and this is what comes next. With even very little description of how you do it, because it was presumed that you'd go to the Kalari and that you already knew basic positions and everything. And there was all this idea that it was the oldest of all martial arts and things like that. And and in Bharatanatyam, we were coming to terms with the fact that it was an invented tradition. And in the way in which yoga and tai chi and all those kinds of art forms, people are showing how they are, you know, a generation, basically. They exist within bodies, and therefore what you have to look at is the generation ahead of you, basically. And now that we have video, maybe it's a bit different, but certainly at that time we didn't even have access to many recordings of the art forms. And trying to get across something of that's not trivial about a martial art form and about an embodied form was it was really great to have Philip's example of somebody who was both a practitioner and a writer about the art form. So I started, I was very, very, very inspired by that, that it could be done, that it could be done well. Now, I'm very interested in Ben's approach, which is that you could do a video essay, and I really have suggested it already to students of mine like Gautam, and but it wasn't an option that was open to me at the time, and therefore my thinking naturally went towards writing about the form, writing something that was worth saying.
Okay.
And it's still a struggle. It's still not easy to be accurate and still have something to say and that it be non-fiction. You know, it's not one of these mythologies about the form that build up so quickly.
Do you know much about the process of the kind of reinvention of Kalaripayat? Because I mean, it's a hugely popular myth that it is the granddaddy of all martial arts, and that it, you know, in that kind of simple origin narrative of Indian monks brings Kalari to China.
Yeah.
It's really, people love that stuff. I mean, do you have any insights into the, that you want to share into the kind of reinvention of it for modern reasons?
Well, you know, the same, the in, invention happened in my dance form, Bharatanatyam. And around the same time, the invention happened in Kalaripayattu with a very a charismatic figure. You very often see pictures of him in the Kalari, and he's in a nice pose and everything. And he was the person, he was a charismatic figure who went to, who kind of straddles the old master, and was able to kind of construct a narrative for it that fit with that time, which was Indian independence. It was around the time of Indian independence. So many of the same aspects that were true of other art forms, that India wanted to have its own art forms. That we didn't want just to be talking about Western things. And that so very similar narratives were constructed around Kalaripayattu, as were constructed around Bharatanatyam. And in order to bring it into prominence around the 1940s, 1930s and 1940s, that it was, but when I went back to my teachers to kind of look at what they said about it and what I knew to be true, it was really hard. I mean, it was obvious to me that a kind of mythologizing was necessary at a certain point in the history of the art form, that it wouldn't have taken on it wouldn't have gotten the students, it wouldn't have taken on the aura that it did. It was necessary for its propagation. And what you can say about it factually is that there was this guy, he was a CVN, and that's why many of the Kalaris are called CVN Kalari. They kind of go back to his understanding of what Kalaripayattu was. And you can tell that he was in the way of people in that generation. He wasn't really concerned with authenticity, that, you know, this is exactly the way it was taught to me. Yes. He was willing to, for example, put fencing moves into the dagger sequence, moves that came directly from a fencing tradition rather than from the Kalaripayattu tradition. And you'll see that that move is there in the dagger sequence of Kalaripayattu. And that CVN had a brief fling with fencing. And so, you know, this the way the tradition was invented was not with our present day obsession with authenticity. This is how it should be. This is how it was taught to me. This is how it exactly has to change. But that mythology of it having been the mother of all martial arts served a purpose at one point. And so we can't just dismiss these as fictions. Yeah. They're perhaps necessary fictions. And then the same as with my style, Bharatanatyam, it was necessary for it to survive at a certain point to have the fiction associated with it. And you know, in my master's art form, he's been practicing his father, so it's a three generations. His father, him, and his son are all Kalaripayattu practitioners, but that it's only his grandfather, and not like going back generations and generations in his lineage. And he doesn't like that to be widely known, and he got very, very upset with his daughter-in-law when she put it on their website that, oh, you know, it was his grandfather. His grandfather learned it when he was a young man from this person that CBN had kind of brought into prominence, and he studied it. And under most circumstances, you'd think, oh, well, you know, that's just how I learned it. But now that's that part of his history, he's kind of keeps it a little bit suppressed. Mm-hmm. He'd like it to be thought that he was, you know, generations of his family were practitioners of Kalaripayat.
So if, I mean, that you've got, you understand the complexity of lineage and tradition and ideology and myth, and in constructing what you just used the word aura. But when you were in Cardiff a couple of years ago and you did your talk, I mean, the question that I asked you, because you argued that you if you've just seen Kalaripayat on YouTube, you haven't seen Kalaripayat, and I think you were evoking the necessary sensuous phenomenological experience of being somewhere, like in a place, in a culture, in a time, in a context, before you can really experience it. But you're saying that that's all just a sort of a complex construct rather than an essence of any kind. I mean, what can you say more about that? Like what you meant when you say, if you've just seen it on YouTube, you haven't seen it.
Okay, well, I probably come to change my mind about video at this point. I mean, especially after listening to Ben's talk about it and understanding that my way of approaching the screen is very different from a present day generation's way of approaching the screen. I mean, so many people have come to me during the lockdown to say, can I teach a Kalaripayat class online? And I know that it's something that I'm simply not capable of doing, but it doesn't mean that it's not happening. People are teaching Kalaripayat online, and I guess it's just my way of understanding how embodiment is a process that happens over time with bodies, and what my body is capable of understanding by looking at a video is not what other bodies are, and a body that's been brought up having looked at screens from the time they were very, very small, look at screens differently than I do. And it puts a barrier that's a barrier for me that isn't a barrier for my young students. They don't see it the same way. They don't respond to it the same way. And of course, coming to the realization that my experience of seeing things through a screen is not a universal way, it's really happened over the last few years as people interact through the screen more and more. I've realized, okay, I'm not the final expression of this. At the same time, every person who takes up Kalaripayat and then goes to the Kalari in Kerala and practices there finds that their understanding of Kalari is not, it is deepened by the experience of being there. At the same time, not everybody can go there, and now this is going to become a reality that you can't just get on a plane and go off to Kerala to study Kalaripayat. You know, COVID-19 realities mean that maybe people are going to try to find other ways to respond to embodied practice that don't involve bodies being in the same space together.
So what have you seen of the globalization or internationalization of Kalaripayat? I mean, is it something that do you see schools and classes everywhere you've been, or is it still something that maybe it's only in a few metropolises or outside of India? I mean, how much are you aware of Kalaripaya dispersing around the world?
Yeah, I do. I do see quite, I mean, a lot has happened within the last 30 years that I've been involved with Kalaripaya. London, Paris have long-standing centers of Kalaripaya practice. And there's there are a couple of classes in Paris, there are a couple of classes in London that have been going on for 10 years, I mean, more than 10 years. I don't even want to say how long they've been going on. They've been going on for long enough that there are students who've practiced only there, that they've been able to have their practice. Phillips Kalari in Tiny Park, that's been going on for quite a long time too. I can't remember how long he's been in Wales, but it's his intensive has been going on for close to 20 years, if not more than 20 years. It's been happening there. And there are people who are doing it in Japan. I see them when they come to Kerala. I meet Japanese practitioners of Kalaripaya, German, Austrian, Swiss, quite a few Americans. And the Kalaris that have become popular do get so many for, like Sharif Gurkal's Kalari in Kerala. He has a separate practice period and a separate Kalari, as I understand, for his students from Europe.
So you get, there is a definite kind of pilgrimage, like people will go, going this summer, I'm going for 2 months, 3 months to Kerala, the same way that people want to go to the Shaolin Temple, or they want to go to Brazil to learn capoeira. It's got that kind of gravitas, that kind of magnetism to get the, is that because of the authentic masters, or because of they want the culture, or what do you think? Is it expertise, or is it broader than that?
Well, I have to say from my own experience that it's broader than that. I mean, there is something very hard to replace with the practice in the Kalari, because in Kalaripaya, the place of practice and the form itself are considered to be united. You know, that Kalari is the word for the space. It's not the word for the form. It's the payat. It's the thing that you do in the Kalari. And so that mud floor, that kind of sweaty Kerala climate, and practicing with your guru in that space is very different than doing it in a gym or in a with a wood floor and with the fan and the air conditioning and whatnot. It's a very, very different kind of experience.
Okay, I'm gonna share a screen. I'm not gonna share that screen. I'm gonna share first of all. So you've got stuff all over the internet, haven't you? We've got the video of your keynote that you gave at our conference, and then you do have films on Kalaripaya and all sorts of things about you on YouTube, haven't you? I mean, are you turning more to YouTube now, or is this just, it's not a deliberate choice of yours? It's just other people film you more now, or what's your relationship with that?
I think it's other people putting it up, because it's none of it is what I have done. Okay. And during the time that this lockdown has been going on, people have been teaching Kalari Payat online, but not me. I haven't been able to get my head around it. And as I said, I think it's just the way that my embodiment has worked out, and a new generation isn't going to find it a problem. But I think the only things that I've put online, which I don't know how to share with you at all, is choreography that I've done using Kalari Payat as that vocabulary as the form for dance-like choreography, which I think it really lends itself to. Like my first master, Benoit, he worked with this guy, Zingaro, who's a choreographer in Paris. Mm-hmm. And he created a piece called Triptych using Kalari Payat. That was Philip and I, when we worked together, we definitely use the Kalari Payat vocabulary. Mm-hmm. So if I were ever to put anything online, or if any of the stuff that is online comes from me, it's choreography where I use Kalari Payat as the as the vocabulary. And I do think it has.
Yeah.
It has a lot of potential in that way, and a lot of people are using it like that. Mm-hmm. And
sorry, I'm just sharing this other screen on, Anna. Is that distracting you? I'm looking at some of your books. I mean, you've had a diverse and kind of controversial career, haven't you? In terms of, I mean, you got a kind of infamy from this book, didn't you? This Sleeping with Movie Stars book. Do you want to tell us something a little bit about the Sleeping with Movie Stars book?
Well, so when I stopped dancing, which in my 50s, because I realized that I couldn't keep dancing unless I spent at least 4 or 5 hours of conditioning practice every day, and I just decided I'm just not doing it anymore. I can't do it. Mm-hmm. I don't have the physical resources to do it. I started writing, and Sleeping with Movie Stars is a collection of short stories based on learning this Bharatanatyam style and performing Bharatanatyam. So it was an attempt to use the resources and the mode of interacting with my own physical practice, mm-hmm. and try to write about the experience of being a dancer. I just think it's one of the things that isn't that well written about, or isn't even written about very much. Mm-hmm. Being a writer, writers are constantly, the protagonists of stories are very often writers, and writers do it themselves. And painters and musicians are kind of also very often characters in novels and short stories, but dancers very rarely are. And I just really wanted to write about the experience of being a dancer. What is it like, and what does it do to you? And especially of the form Bharatanatyam. It has a rich literary tradition, so it seemed kind of natural to go into writing about it. So I am working on a book, Paul. I'm working on a book about dance in India. Oh. And even finding a definition for dance that for me includes practices that are physical, like capoeira and Kalari Payat, that kind of are on the edge, finding a definition that would allow me to include some of these other physical practices.
Is this literary, or is it scholarly, or is it a kind of crossover of different genres?
I'm hoping it'll be a little bit of a crossover, because it's nonfiction definitely, like it's a, it, but I, it's not an academic book. Mm-hmm. But the publishers would like it to be a resource about Indian dance for the non-academic reader, I suppose, not just for scholars, but for people who want to understand what's going on with Indian dance. And that's written not from that perspective of, oh yeah, I believe that it's a 2,000-year-old form. It's comes from the Natya Shastra, the kind of mythology that's been built about Indian dance forms. I do want to dispel some of that, but in a way that the lay reader will find interesting, I suppose.
Okay, and is that, does that have a publication date, or do you have a deadline?
Yeah, it's supposed to be with the publisher by the end of this year, so I'm okay. Working on it right
now. Will it be?
And yeah. Well, I do try to yeah. live up to my deadlines, but I was supposed to be in India doing research. I was supposed to be traveling around looking at different forms, and I don't know when I'll be able to do that, or if I'll be able to do that. You know, this is the more important question.
Hasn't Kerala been a remarkable success story in terms of controlling the coronavirus? I mean, I read the news yesterday that they just anticipated it. They just locked down. They just went, well, what should we do? And they just did that.
I know. Yeah. My friend Brandy, who's a dancer that I've worked with, who does Kalaripayat and who takes part in my choreographic work a lot. She's there, and she just decided to stay there. So she stayed in the Kalari. So when the lockdown was starting, she just said, no, I'm not coming back, because she felt so safe. And it turns out that she's much less likely to get Kalaripayat where she is than in Toronto even.
Yeah.
The number of cases has been remarkably low. I can't. It's kind of amazing what they've done in Kerala.
They just did it right. They just the governors listened to the scientists, and they said, okay, then we'll put these protective measures in place, and it worked. So So yeah. I mean, maybe you could. Maybe you could get there this year. Maybe there'll be quarantine measures and so on, but hopefully you could get there, right?
Yeah, but you know, when you talk about something like dance in India, any kind of, it's just from all the way from Manipuri in the northeast, and the martial art associated with that, Tanta, and how the two interact. It's really interesting. I'd love to go to Manipur and figure that out. And the same with the dance forms that are part of ritual traditions in North Himachal, and which have had a huge Tibetan influence. And then all the variety of Indian dance forms that are hardly even spoken about. I feel really sad. I was supposed to be there at this time.
I think we all feel a bit like that about the future, don't we? And about places we were hoping to be and hoping to go. And yeah, all we can do is just hope that we can move again. I mean, you know, metaphorically and literally, and in all the different senses. But I'm going to say, the internet's getting a bit glitchy again, so I think we should quit while we're ahead. And I would say, Geeta, thank you so much. It's been lovely to see you, albeit only virtually, as opposed to, we were hoping to meet again in at the conference in Marseille this summer, but that isn't going to happen. So. But there will be other conferences, and there will be Kalaripayat, and there will be dance, and there. So, Geeta, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul.